You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. David Sobey, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you're the CEO of Happy Returns. Happy Returns is in the reverse logistics space. This is a topic that has come up here and there on the podcast, but we haven't had a chance to go super deep into it. So I'm really excited about that. How do you describe Happy Returns?
Yeah, so we describe Happy Returns as a software, services, and logistics company that's tackling the painful challenge of returning products purchased online. And from a mission statement, we talk about wanting to make returns beautiful, making returns beautiful for shoppers, for retailers, for location partners, and for the planet.
Okay. So tell me more about beautiful for the customer. What does that look like?
Well, so today, or I should say prior to Happy Returns, if you were a retailer that sold online, there were really two options for your customers. If you had stores, you could direct people to buy online and return to store. But more and more, and especially over the last decade, there's been the rise of direct-to-consumer brands that don't necessarily have stores and that sell primarily online. And so for those customers, there was one option, which was put it in the mail. And customers are pretty dissatisfied with the idea of put it in the mail because of the hassle and weight that's involved.
Getting the postage and all that kind of stuff is annoying.
Yeah. So we think about kind of three big friction points. The first is what we call the arts and crafts project, which is, you know, most online returns via the mail start with some version of print a label.
Right.
You have to secure a box, right? Figure out how you're going to ship this thing. You have to wrestle with packing tape, right? To somehow...
And maybe you don't have those supplies on hand.
Exactly.
Right.
So that's sort of, you know, one friction point is the arts and crafts. The second is your reward for completing your arts and crafts project is that you have to go interact with a carrier, which is not quite as bad as going to the DMV, but can be. Everyone can relate to waiting in line at the post office and just how unsatisfying that experience is. Mm-hmm. And then the third is the wait, right? So once you've, you know, made your box and printed your label and gone and dropped it off with the carrier, your reward for all of that is to then wait and go check your credit card statement for the next 2 to 3 weeks and wait to see when you get your refund back. And so, you know, when we think about making returns beautiful for customers, we think about really trying to reimagine that whole process and try to improve every aspect of it. And so, you know, in a happy return, there's no preparation required. You simply come to a return bar. You interact with a human being who we joke that we're the only people in America that are excited to see you when you have a return.
It's your job. So yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And our partner's job. And, you know, you name the company Happy Returns, you have to, you know, have to really live up to that. So there's no preparation, there's no work. You simply come in, you tell us where you bought it, what email address you used when you checked out, answer a few questions, you know, why are you returning it? How do you want your money back? And then you get an email receipt from us and we communicate to the retailer to go ahead and initiate either the refund or the exchange, depending on what the customer chose. And that's it. And that whole process takes about 60 seconds. It's super easy. Customers love it. They love avoiding the kind of hassle and wait of returns by mail. You know, we've created this new way to returns that we think makes returns beautiful for shoppers because it eliminates all of that friction.
It definitely feels like nowadays everyone who is buying stuff online has a small fulfillment center in the front of their apartment or house where things are happening, boxes are coming in, stuff needs to go back out. I have definitely not returned things many times because I was too lazy to do it or something, too busy to do it, and then want to go through the hassle of it and just figure it out, whatever. I'll give that away to someone.
Yeah, no, that's very real. We think a lot about the sales that are missed online because people, you know, go through that mental process of anticipating if this doesn't work out, how painful will it be to actually have to go through and ship this back? And while we all are excited about the growth of e-commerce and, you know, you can read tons of headlines about how fast it's growing, you know, from a penetration standpoint, it's still really underpenetrated, right?
Yeah.
I think the last number I saw was about 12% of all shopping is done online. Why is that? And we would posit that returns and the pain of returns and the anticipated pain of returns is a big thing that's sort of holding back the growth of e-commerce.
I think in China, it's way higher. I think it's like 30 or 40% in China compared to in the US. And it might be something about part of it is just the logistics of how many, you know, people who live, you know, not in a big city don't necessarily have access to all of the same, like you're talking about just being able to ship things back to the brand or the company that sold it to them. The first time I interacted with Happy Returns, I think, was at a mall, like a few years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, was the first time I ever saw the name of your company. I think it was in Glendale here. I had never come across it. And I think it's fascinating for a company that is a technology company to have to solve the in-person physical problem of developing locations. How did you decide early on that that was important as opposed to handling it more in a more abstract way through reverse logistics centers and doing it completely via mail?
Yeah. So we always, you know, and I should maybe start by explaining how we got into this business. So Mark and I worked at a company called Hotlook here in mm-hmm. LA. And if you know the Hotlook story, we got bought by Nordstrom. And one of the programs that we worked on after the acquisition was letting our shoppers buy online and return products to Nordstrom Rack stores. And the insights that we gained working on that were really what led to founding the company. And so a simple way to think about what we were trying to do when we launched was, can we replicate that case study, right? For all of the Hotlooks out there, you know, all the direct-to-consumer businesses that don't have a parent like Nordstrom Rack. And so, you know, that was one of the initial questions was, okay, well, where are we going to put these return bars? And we thought shopping malls seem like a natural place. One, people are already used to the idea of going there, right? Mm-hmm. And they're already used to the idea of shopping there. So, you know, it felt like it fit from a customer standpoint. Another big driver was if you look at foot traffic into physical retail and specifically into shopping malls, it's really fallen off a cliff, right? I think the number is it's off by half in the last 6 years. And so we thought, what other segment or what other, you know, type of business would be as receptive to what we were doing, right? Because if you think about it, in simple terms, we're driving internet shoppers who instead would have gone to the post office or the UPS store or the FedEx location back into physical retail to do a return. And so we thought, well, the shopping mall should welcome us with, you know, open arms because mm-hmm. we're sort of reconnecting the dots between, you know, the physical places they have and digital places.
Well, that was a part of the story that I was not at all familiar with, actually, because I had just, in my mind, mostly thought about the consumer and then the brands that you're working with. But then there is this benefit for the malls or the retail partners that you have who are hosting these bars. And then there's also the like actual like logistics side of all of it. So there's a lot of different folks that you're bringing together here.
Yeah, yeah. So we think about three stakeholders, right? There's the consumer, and mm-hmm. we talked a little bit about, you know, the shopper pain. For the locations, and we've expanded from malls. So we're now in a number of big national store networks, places like Paper Source and Sur La Table. We just completed a successful pilot with Cost Plus World Market, and we're going to be expanding into a number more Cost Plus World Markets. We're in college bookstores, and we're starting to dabble in some co-working facilities as well, which is kind of exciting. So bringing the service into, you know, an actual place of work. Anyway, so the, you know, on that side of the house, it's really about driving foot traffic, right? And it's about driving foot traffic from, you know, digital shoppers into physical retail to get this service that people want. You know, everybody wants the ability to buy online and return to store. And for the locations, it's really, hey, this is a simple service that, you know, your employees can execute. We make it really easy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an iPad app basically that we train them on how to use. We provide all of the sort of supplies that they need in the form of poly bags and reusable boxes, you know, reusable totes to ship in. We organize the pickup of the goods. And all they really need to do is have their employees execute our service and do it with a smile. But yeah, on that side of the house, it's really a pretty simple exchange of value. It's, you know, they operate our service in exchange for the foot traffic that we drive.
And is that just like, you know, nobody's paying each other in that model, or are they paying you, or are you paying them? How does that even work?
Yeah. So today, there's no payment, meaning we don't pay them. They don't pay us.
That's a very fascinating arrangement, yeah. Because you have to be able to prove the value on both sides. And so how do you do that?
Yeah, so location partners always want to know a couple of things. So first, they want to say, how challenging will this be for my employees to execute the service? And so, again, we focused on making it really easy. It's an app that mm-hmm. We can train people on how to use in about 15 minutes. And so that part is fairly straightforward. So we've really gotten good over the last, you know, 4 years at a really simple design that's consistent across the retailers that, you know, so it could be a Rothy's return or it could be an Everlane return or a Revolve return. The process in the app flows exactly the same way, regardless of the little differences in the return policy and process of those retailers. So one is making it really easy for the store associates or mall associates to execute. The second, as you point out, is really trying to quantify the value of the foot traffic, right? So, okay, it's great that you're driving people into my store, but are they actually buying anything, right? Mm-hmm. And so there we do a lot of work with post-transaction surveys. So literally emailing the customers after they complete a return to ask them two simple questions. One, if you hadn't been doing the return today, would you have gone into the mall or the paper source of the Sur La Table anyway to try to get a sense of, is the traffic itself incremental? And then the second question is, did you buy anything while you were there, right? Mm-hmm. And what we're trying to do is really trying to build the business case for the location partner that, you know, one, this traffic is incremental, and two, people are buying things. And so that's sort of one data set. And then the other, and this is relatively new, is every time a shopper does a return, they get an email receipt from the transaction, and we've started putting coupons inside of those emails. Mm. So if you return to a paper source, you might get a paper source coupon for, say, 10% off, you know, your next purchase at paper source. And the idea is that now paper source has a way through scanning those coupons to track their own side to say, you know, how many redemptions of this coupon did we see? Because we know this is specific to Happy Returns. And so using those two different numbers, the survey number and the coupon, you know, response, we're able to triangulate around the value of the traffic.
Wow. Is it accurate to say you're trying to do this in a self-serve way also? There's like a new kiosk or something that you're working on?
Yeah. So that was a new offering that we announced earlier this year. It is a self-service kiosk. And the idea, there's sort of two applications for this. So one is in a busy location that is maybe, you know, where the store associates or just have too much traffic. The kiosk could be there to, it's sort of like a virtual assistant. Yeah. You know, a customer could self-service their return. The other use case, and really where the idea came from, was a lot of omni-channel retailers, so people that have their own store networks, are really drowning in dot-com returns. And dot-com returns coming into the stores create all kinds of challenges. One is long lines at checkout, right?
Sure.
And if you're a store, you know, you want to make it as easy to check out as possible. And so, you know, internet shoppers that are, you know, gumming up the works in the checkout line are, pose a problem. Second, you know, most store associates hate dealing with returns. You know, oftentimes they're commission-based salespeople and, you know, they want to sell. They don't want to, you know, deal with these returns. And then third is the inventory itself often may not be something that the store carries, right? Because most retailers have a very broad assortment online and a very narrow assortment that's sort of tailored for the market in their store. So it's quite possible that that internet shopper walking in to return something they bought online might not be a product that the store actually carries. Hmm. And so now as a store manager, you have this quandary, which is, you know, you've carefully planned down to the square inch probably how you want to merchandise your store. Now you have this kind of onesie-twosie internet return that you need to sell. And you could see this if you walked into kind of any Nordstrom today. You know, you'd see a very carefully planned floor. And then in one corner, you might see kind of a rounder with onesie-twosie items. Those are most likely internet returns that the store doesn't carry.
Right.
And often then, you know, they sort them by size. Oftentimes, these will be discounted. The stores really dislike that inventory because it sort of creates the idea of a discount store. So it's a complex challenge. And the idea of the return kiosk was, well, can we alleviate the lines at checkout? Can we make this easier for store associates because customers can self-service? And then the logistic piece of what we do, can we actually come help them rebalance that inventory, right? Pick up the things they don't want in stores, that they don't want to keep in the store, and get it back via reverse logistics to the fulfillment center or whatever the next best place is to sell it.
But is the kiosk designed specifically for brands who want to process their own returns? It's not like the return bar where I can bring products from any brand?
Yeah, so what we introduced in March was really about, yes, a brand's own returns.
Got it.
So, you know, bought it on brand's internet business, you know, their .com site, and returning it into the brand store. That said, I think we're going to start deploying some of these in some of the busier return bar locations that are today are manned by people, just because some of the traffic, some of these busiest stores are seeing is starting to get a little overwhelming. You know, I had the first call. I've been waiting for this for 4 years, right? I had a call from a COO of one of our location partners last Friday, and she said, "Hey, David, you know, that forecast you provided in January is actually turning out to be true," meaning, you know, you've increased more than doubled the volume of people coming into our stores this year, and that's great, but it's some of the busiest locations, it's starting to be a problem.
Right.
And, you know, especially on like a busy Saturday when a lot of the return volume happens, you know, it can be overwhelming, right?
Sure.
To have, you know, 20, 30, 40 people walking in to do returns, you know, and the stores aren't necessarily staffed for that. We have all kinds of ideas of ways that we can help them address this, but, you know, the idea of a multi-brand kiosk branded Happy Returns might end up being part of the solution set.
So what actual work needs to happen at that moment when you're picking it up? Because eventually somewhere along the line, you know, you're processing a refund, but you need to figure out, is this product, what is this thing? First of all, like what brand, what SKU, what is the value of this thing that we can refund? Does this belong to a real order? Is there any damage with this, you know, product that is not covered by the warranty? Like how much of that are you trying to figure out up front? How much is figured out later? Where does that decision making happen?
Now we're really going to get into the logistic piece of our yeah. business. Yeah. So the way it works at the intake location, so think about this as the return bars. The customer provides the retailer that they bought it from and their email address. We use that email address to connect to the back end of the retailer to pull up all of the order history associated with that account. And so in that order history, you'd find the actual products they purchased, whether or not it's returnable or not, right? Because it might be that something was final sale, or it might be that the retailer has, let's say, you know, it's a 30-day return window, and now here we are at day 65, so that item would be ineligible for return, right? So that the app is basically pulling up the customer's purchase history so that the store associate can match the item that's being returned to something in the history. So let's assume, you know, I'm wearing a gray shirt today, so let's assume we use my gray shirt. The store associate would say, yep, David, I see, you know, the gray shirt here. You know, this was an Everlane shirt. It was size medium. So the store associate is checking the attributes of the shirt to make mm-hmm. sure that they match. The app then prompts them to collect whatever information is required by that retailer in order to process the return. So you could think about kind of three things. One is, why are you returning it? So whatever those that retailer's set of reasons are that they want to collect will be offered, and the store associate and the customer have to decide which one is it. So maybe I'm returning it because it didn't fit well. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it was too big. The next set of information is, how would you like your refund back, right? And so if I'm returning it because it was too big, our app will actually check the available inventory and say, well, you know, David's returning the large gray shirt. He said it was too big. Let's make sure that we propose the medium gray shirt to him to see whether or not he just wants a different size, right? Mm. And so a different size and different color exchanges are something that we support. And so that okay. would be one of the refund options would be, you know, I want to do an exchange. Typically, the other two refund options are original payment method, you know, so however you bought it, or store credit, if the retailer offers that. And then the third step is the store associate does a cursory inspection to confirm the item is in returnable condition.
Hmm.
These conditions are provided by the retailer for something like apparel. In my shirt example, it would typically be, is the shirt unworn? Is it unwashed? Is it unaltered? Something like shoes might say, you know, the original box has to be there. And what we guide the store associates to do is we say, hey, if you bought this new and you received it and it was in this condition, you know, would it be acceptable to you?
Hmm.
And sort of use common sense there. So from there, assuming it passes that cursory inspection, you know, the customer gets their email receipt. They go on their way, typically happy, right?
Because uh-huh.
Their refund has been That's initiated. Good. We've signaled to the retailer, we have David's gray shirt. You know, he wants his money back to original payment method. Go ahead and give him that refund. From there, and this is where I think your question lies, like what happens? So the item gets put into a poly bag that we provide. We seal the poly bag. We use our app to scan a QR code on the bag. And what we're essentially doing is we're associating the data from the return with that actual physical bag. And then that bag gets put into a reusable tote. So it's a branded Happy Returns tote. You know, the rule is either 10 items or every third day. You know, that'll dispatch one of our carrier partners to come pick up that reusable tote. So the store associate simply zips the tote closed. We send them a return label, they print it out, they stick it in the plastic sheath on the front of the reusable tote. FedEx or UPS or whichever carrier partner we're using comes and scoops that up. And then it gets sent to one of our return hubs. Mm-hmm. So these are regional processing hubs. And so this is a commingled shipment, right? We might have taken in, you know, 40 items during the course of the day at that return bar from 20 different retailers. They're all going to travel together mm-hmm. from the return bar to the return hub.
Yeah.
And this is really where the cost savings starts to come in for retailers, is because everyone's items are traveling together. It's much less expensive than individual boxes that the retailer mm-hmm. has to pay for. At the return hub, we sort all the items, check them in to make sure that they're all there. We sort by retailer. And now this is where there can be more inspection. Mm-hmm. This is where there can be refurbishment. You know, if something's in restockable condition, it can be as simple as kind of fold bag label. If, you know, something is damaged and, you know, we're empowered to actually attempt to refurbish the item and try to get it back in resellable condition, we will do that. Then we're taking all of the Everlane returns, for example. We're preparing them all to be whatever the next destination is, if it's going to be restocked. And then we're aggregating. And so what we're shipping back to Everlane then is a pallet full of returns, right? Again, taking advantage of aggregation to try to reduce the cost of shipping, right? And so what Everlane, you know, gets from us, you know, three days a week is a pallet of returns, you know, that come in from whatever region of the country the return hub is in. We have an East Coast one and a West Coast one. And so Everlane receives a pallet of returns that have come in from the return bar network, all of which have been bagged, all of which have been folded, all of which have been labeled, you know, barcode on each bag. They get a manifest, right? It's called, in industry terms, an ASN, an advanced shipping notice. And then they can check all of that pallet's worth of returns in against the ASN and simply scan and put away, right? Everything is ready to be resold at that point.
Is there an amount of volume that you have to be doing as a retailer where that aggregation really starts to work, or where this whole process actually makes sense?
There isn't necessarily a hard and fast number, but it's in the thousands of returns a month.
Got it.
As opposed to, you know, hundreds, just to give you an order of magnitude. You know, we work with a range of retailers, some of which are, you know, really small, some of which are massive, right? We launched Revolve last month. So massive business going public this week, closing in on $1 billion in gross sales, really high return rate. So a lot of that stuff ends up coming back, and we're their partner for that.
And so obviously, you know, high return rate, what are the industries or categories where you see that? Clothing, we've talked a lot about that. Seems obvious because people want to try things on, and fashion, you know, there's a lot of personal taste involved. Are there other categories that are less obvious?
You know, in any startup, you need focus, right?
Uh-huh.
And given our backgrounds, you know, with the Haute Look to Nordstrom Rack, that's an area that we know well. So the majority of our customers are apparel, shoes, or accessories.
Hmm.
It's the single largest category online. It also is the fastest growing. It also has, as you point out, these just sort of endemic return issues because of fit and style, right? You know, it's like, I can't try the shoes on, so what do? I buy multiple sizes, right?
Sure.
Or, you know, things just don't fit. Most of our customers are in apparel, shoes, and accessories. We work with a home goods company, Parachute Home.
Sure. They're one of our best customers. They've been with us for a long time. And Ariel, who's the CEO, has been on the show before.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. I don't remember the episode, probably in the 30s or something.
Yeah. So obviously Parachute is home goods, right? Mm-hmm. And so we can return, you know, robes and sheets and towels and all the soft goods side of Parachute. We struggle with things like beds, right? Or furniture,
yeah,
or anything that's large, just because can't fit that in a poly bag. So,
well, also can't necessarily fit that in your car when you're, I mean, there's a lot of different steps there where that might be challenging.
Exactly. But yeah, so home goods is an area. Increasingly, we're looking at things in toys.
Hmm.
You know, obviously with the demise of Toys R Us and the growth of, you know, online shopping, a lot of toys are online. Home goods, I mentioned, eventually I think we'll get to consumer electronics. Today we haven't done anything in that, but we're still proving that the model works in apparel, shoes, and accessories. And so I think that'll be, you know, a lot of our focus for at least for the foreseeable future.
Is there a range that you give to people of how long is my inventory going to be out there kind of like moving around this whole system? You know, what's the shortest time from when a customer drops it off to it being back in my warehouse as a brand? And what's the longest time that it might be?
Yeah, great question. So we put this in our contract,
A
service level agreement. But on the short end, you're talking about probably 6 or 7 business days.
Hmm.
On the long end, it can be as much as 14 business days.
That seems really short. That seems a lot shorter than I would have expected if you're trying to aggregate, you know, entire pallets of stuff to send back.
Yeah, it's not always pallets, right? Hmm. If the retailer doesn't, you know, we'll do parcel.
Not high.
Right. But yeah, there's these two hops, right? From the return bar to the hub, and then from the hub back to the retailer. You know, I mentioned that we have a rule around how frequently we ship from the bars to the hub. We also can control how frequently we ship from the hub back to the retailer. You know, as you point out, like aggregation is our friend. And so the longer amount of time we have, the better from a cost perspective. But a lot of the retailers we work with, you know, they're selling things that are in season. And so, you know, if you're Revolve, it may be that summer's ending and this is a swimsuit and you want to get it back on the shelf to sell as soon as possible. And so,
I mean, that's just one of the biggest costs for any physical goods company is just the having the inventory out there is, you know, just a huge cash float. And the more you can reduce the amount of time there, the better off you are as a company.
Agreed. Yeah. And I think one of the really interesting, you know, new decisions that we are enabling for retailers is if you think about it, coming out of our hubs, you know, we really don't care where the items are going. Meaning to us, it's a label on a pallet or a label on a box. And so it may be that these are items that are damaged. And so they're being, you know, donated or recycled. It might be that this is something that's out of season. And so, you know, the next logical place or best place to sell this item might not be the retailer. It might be onto liquidation. Most of our retailers today are just having items sent back or, you know, damaged items donated. But I think a forward-thinking retailer will start to think about, you know, specific rules around the item itself. I always use the example of a swimsuit in September. You know, don't send me the swimsuit back in September because chances are I'm not, there isn't really a market for me to sell this again until the next spring.
So when you think back to, I don't remember how many years ago, was it 8 or 9 years, Warby Parker launches with the home try-on kit. And I think that that was like a pretty revolutionary concept at the time. That was a very specific experience to that brand. They're sending you 5 pairs because they're trying to solve that problem that we've been talking about, which is, hey, you know, I want to see how this fits. I don't know if I like this style. But they came up with a very tailored kit that had a return plan built in. Where does it make sense for a brand to handle it themselves versus work with you? Or would you want to take on picking up those returned glasses, the pairs that were not accepted by the customer? That's a very specific thing, right?
Yeah. So hats off to Warby Parker for thinking about that and really putting the customer experience first, right? If you think about most retailers would not be forward-thinking enough to say, yes, we're going to incur that cost, right? We're going to send you more stuff.
Right, because it was free, I think, or you didn't pay up front for that. I forget how it worked.
I think it was
if you put your credit card in.
If you bought something that they would waive the, you know, the shipping if you returned it all. But it's been a while since I looked at it. But that makes sense for something like glasses where, you know, the cost of shipping a pair of glasses is not that great compared to, say, the cost of shipping a pair of shoes. Now, there's been a lot of talk in some companies that have been experimenting with sort of try before you buy, right? And the idea of everything from sort of Trunk Club, where it's explicitly the business model,
right,
to there was a company called Jack Threads that experimented with this a bit. And then, of course, the rise of subscription, all right? So like the Rent the Runway subscription for clothing rental. I think it's a real use case. I think there are challenges. If you're a retailer, I would say don't enter that lightly because these are real costs, right? I mean, it's expensive. There are all kinds of implications from a seasonality, right? And you know, if items are out being tried on, you know, you need to have rules to make sure that you can get them back in season to be able to try to resell them. We have found that most retailers that don't start with subscription or don't start with some kind of try before you buy don't have the core competence in returns and thinking through reverse logistics enough to go ahead and launch something. That said, there are businesses, and I would think about Rent the Runway or the Black Tux or La Tote, that, you know, the entire business and the model and the offering was tailored around this. And so those are companies that said, gosh, we're going to have to be good at this. We're going to have to think through this. We're going to have to build into our pricing the fact that we're going to be paying for a lot of shipping both ways. We're going to have, you know, inventory that's, you know, we might have lower sell-throughs because items are being tried on, right? So it's not something that you can just sort of bolt onto a business that, you know, if you're selling things, I would say that enter it when you're confident that this is what your customers want, the way Warby Parker did, and really thinking through, you know, is this appropriate? And then making sure that they invest to have the core competencies to actually execute well.
Another company that I had a really interesting return experience with recently was a company called Adams. Do you know them? They make...
Is that the shoe?
Yeah, they make these shoes, but they sell these shoes. I guess they've been in like a beta type of phase for about a year or something like that and just recently launched officially where everyone can buy now. But they sell shoes in quarter sizes. And the whole idea is you can keep 2 different pairs if your feet are slightly different in size. So they'll usually ship you 3 pairs. And it comes in a box within a box and you take the thing. It's pretty well done. I'm amazed that they've been able to figure this out. But, well, they have more SKUs, obviously, because they have different sizes, but they have 3 styles.
Yes.
Does that make a difference in terms of like, when does it make sense? You know, is it more SKUs you have, the better this solution becomes? Or?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's an exponential problem when you start to think about the permutations of size and style, and especially when you think about something like shoes that can have, you know, half sizes, and you know, so it's a challenging problem that is certainly easier when you have a limited set of SKUs. But I think that's a good example of a business that probably started by thinking about the problem they were trying to solve, and likely built into their pricing and their business plan the idea that, yeah, we're going to have inventory that's out in the field. You know, we might send 2 pairs of shoes out, 2 different sizes, and get, you know, the left of one size and the right of another one
back,
right?
Yeah, the whole thing.
You know, my guess, I don't know the business that well, but my guess is that you know, because that was the experience they were trying to create, they built a model that said, yep, we can afford to do this, and you know, built that into pricing.
A topic that comes up a lot on this podcast is, because we're talking a lot about these direct-to-consumer brands that are purposefully operating outside of Amazon, outside of the typical retail ecosystem, is that for the shopper, it becomes a very fragmented experience. They have to, you know, buy from all these different online stores, and some companies, Shopify comes to mind, for example, have helped out by standardizing the checkout experience. And if you put your phone number into a Shopify checkout, regardless of what store you're at, it will kind of bring back your shipping and billing information. Happy Returns seems to fit into that philosophy as well, because, you know, if I have items across a bunch of different brands, I can bring them back to you. But it does put a little bit of work on the customer to remember, like, which of my brands that I buy from that also support Happy Returns. How do you deal with that? I mean, I think it's a good thing and a challenge.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Ideally, we deal with it by
having more customers.
Having more brands, right?
Yeah, that's the easy way.
You know, I dream of a day where, and we just completed some fundraising, so I, you know, I had to describe this often to some of the venture capital investors that we were talking to. You know, what does victory look like for Happy Returns? And I always talk about Amazon Prime, and yeah, the impact that that little logo, that little Prime logo has on my shopping on Amazon, right? And, you know, I make completely irrational economic decisions based on that logo, right? Hmm. I might pay a dollar more for a book because it has the Prime logo. I don't need the book in 2 days, right? You know, there's nothing, it's not that, but what the logo means is it, you know, to me, it's come to mean this problem is done, right? I see the Prime logo there. I know I'm going to get it. I know that if there are any problems, Amazon's going to take care of them. You know, it inspires my confidence in buying. I think we can build that for returns, right? Like I can't wait for the day when there's a customer that says, you know, I can buy from retailer A or retailer B. Retailer A has Happy Returns. Retailer B doesn't. And so I'm going to buy from retailer A.
Yeah.
Right. And we could become, you know, the same way every retailer you go to says free shipping at the, you know, the top of their website. I want them all to say free shipping and Happy Returns, and for customers to seek out retailers that have our service, because it sort of stands for, if this doesn't work out, I know it's going to be easy. You know, I know it's not going to be painful. It's actually going to be delightful because they use Happy Returns. So yeah, we've got a long way to go with regard to adding brand partners, but that is absolutely the vision, is that we become sort of the standard for a great experience in returns, which we got a lot of work to do, clearly. But you know, we know from talking to all kinds of online shoppers and surveys and focus groups, et cetera, that, you know, returns really are this pain point. It's one study that we did. We asked customers about their favorite parts of shopping online and their least favorite parts of shopping online. And not surprisingly, returns were people's least favorite part of shopping online. And so we always think about that, right? It's like, if we can solve people's least favorite part of shopping online, you know, we're doing something right, and hopefully contributing to, you know, the growth of e-commerce.
Lately, there's a thing, I don't know how far they went with this, but you could give your keys to Amazon, right? Did you see this? They'll literally,
like, put it in your trunk.
Yeah, they'll put it in your trunk. You can also give them your home key and they'll put it inside your house.
Oh,
how
does
that work?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think, you know, Amazon absolutely sets the bar, right?
Yeah.
And so with regard to, yeah, I think in that specific example, it was around, you know, a lock that would allow them to put something that you bought on Amazon in your home.
Right.
And I know they're starting to experiment with that, you know, not just delivering it to your porch.
Well, they also bought Ring, and now it's all coming together for me. What, they're just going to unlock your door if you give them, like, Amazon access? Oh God.
Yeah.
It's happening.
Well, so we talk a lot about the Amazon effect in returns. Of course, remember that Amazon bought Whole Foods. When that happened, it was a great day for Happy Returns, because, you know, everyone was out there talking about Amazon's entry into grocery and, you know, the price of ground beef. And we said, hey, yes, this is all about grocery, but it also was about the fact that they just bought, you know, 450 amazing, you know, retail locations in great areas in order to offer shoppers services. And so, you know, the deal closed on a Tuesday, and on Wednesday they announced lockers inside of every Whole Foods location.
Right. I was going to ask you about lockers.
And so, you know, and those lockers are for both pickup and delivery. I'm sorry, for both pickup and returns. And so we said, hey, look, you know, this is them, you know, starting to use the Whole Foods physical stores as a way to kind of deliver a better return experience. About 30 days later, they did this partnership with Kohl's, you know, buy on Amazon, return to Kohl's stores, which was awesome because it just validated our approach, right? It was exactly what we were trying to build, of like, buy online and return to a different store than the one you bought it from. That is Amazon Kohl's partnership, and that essentially is Happy Returns. Right, is that same idea of making an in-store return experience for somebody that bought something online from a retailer that doesn't have them. And so, you know, they announced that partnership, and then recently they announced they're expanding it nationwide. Again, totally validating the approach that we have taken with regard to solving this pain. And so, you know, when we think about Amazon really setting the customer service bar, you know, we say to retailers is, hey, you know, before, if you wanted to equal Amazon from a returns experience, it was just about having free returns because, you know, Amazon sort of pioneered that. Now it's about free in-person returns that don't require any preparation, right? Mm-hmm. That offer an immediate refund. And so, hey, retailer, you know, you got three options, right? If you want to equal Amazon today. So one is, you know, you can build your own store network. Good luck, right? Two is you could probably do a partnership with Kohl's. Again, good luck. Or three, you know, you can work with us and we enable that same buy online return to store experience that, you know, Amazon and Kohl's is trying to create.
I have never tried the locker. Is it, so how does that even work? Is it a self-serve thing and you just put the item that you want to return into the Amazon? It's like a lockbox and then they just refund you and you figure it out from there? Or how do
yeah, so there's a couple variations of it, but the one that's most commonly used is there's still the need to print a label. There's still a need to box. You can think about the locker as just being almost like a Dropbox, mm-hmm. right? Where there can be a barcode that you scan and that'll pop open a locker door and then you put your box in it and presumably then you could get a faster refund right at the time that the box is scanned. You know, lockers have been around for a while and I think that the use and the penetration of lockers is probably not what people, you know, hoped for and when they forecast. That said, I think lockers and certainly, you know, what we're attempting to do with a kiosk is to some degree similar to lockers, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that that's part of the future. I just think it might be, you know, maybe not the near future, maybe the sort of, you know, a little bit the medium term future as opposed to today. We think that, you know, we're sort of changing behavior and the best way to change behavior is with a positive experience and that is, you know, typically led by a person, right? If you think about returns, you know, via the post office, it's a pretty impersonal experience, right? Mm. You know, whereas what we're trying to do is bring some humanity back into the experience. And so change in consumer behavior takes time, right? And it takes time for things to be adopted and for things to become the norm. You know, 4 years ago, we didn't exist. And this sure. idea of, you know, buying from one retailer and returning to another didn't exist. You know, today it does. And, you know, so I think, you know, lockers is part of the long-term solution set. I just think it might be more medium-term than immediate.
Are you have something, you have in the hundreds of locations right now, right? Around 350 or something?
Yeah, 365, I think is the number today.
And so do you envision a world like, I don't know, 10, 20 years from now where you're like Starbucks or something, you have like 40,000, I don't know how many they have, but it's like within walking distance of anyone who is living in a city or something? Or how do you envision that
growing absolutely. From here? And I don't think it's 10 years. I think it's in the next couple. Our goal for this year is to get to 1,000 by the end of the year.
Wow.
So in sort of scope, meaning, you know, with existing partnerships that we're expanding into, we have about 600 of those spoken for. So 365 today that are expanding to 600 this summer. So we still have a little bit of ways to go to hit our 1,000 goal for the year. But yeah, I think that, you know, within the next couple of years, I would like it to be as easy to return to Happy Returns or as convenient as it is to go to the, you know, to go to your post office. Right. Mm. And so I think that that's in the, you know, we need thousands of locations in order to have that kind of convenience. You know, there's a grocery store, a pharmacy chain in their annual report. You know, they have about 10,000 locations. And one of the metrics that they quote in their annual report is, 78% of America lives within a 5-minute drive of one of their, you know, their mm-hmm. pharmacies. That's sort of the scale that I think we would like to get to is, you know, that type of large distributed network that has multiple options, right? So, you know, and it could be on your commute, it could be near your home, it could be near where you work, but that Happy Returns is just kind of everywhere you are or everywhere that shoppers are.
Yeah, that's a fascinating idea to just imagine, like, if you had that within walking distance. I think the argument around how does that change the buyer's experience at the very beginning of the whole process? Like, are there metrics like that that you're actually able to share with brands that come to you? Like, how much, if you provide that really good return experience, how much, like what you were saying with Prime, does that increase your sales?
Yeah, so we have all kinds of, we've done a lot of survey work in this. Mm. And the number that we often talk about is, you know, we asked customers, so these are online shoppers, and we asked them about what they wanted in a return experience for something they purchased online. And, you know, the things that they said were, you know, I want it to be free, number one. I want the refund to be immediate. I don't want to have to print anything, right. Which is kind of interesting.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, no one has a printer anymore anyway.
Yeah. And they actually wanted to do it in person.
Yeah.
And even, we cut the data and we looked actually at the millennial data versus you know, non-millennial. And even at the millennial level, it was like 51% of millennials wanted to return in person, which was actually quite surprising to us. And so then the next question in the survey was around, if a retailer could provide you with that experience, how would it impact your likelihood to shop there? And it was 85% of people said that they would either be much more likely or more likely to shop with a retailer that provided that return experience that had those four attributes to it. And so we often talk about that with retailers and we say, hey, there's value to getting this experience right. And it's a little counterintuitive, right? It's sort of like, if you make returns easy, people are going to reward you by shopping more. When you think about the brands and the retailers that have really become iconic and have, you know, what you would describe as winning in retail, right? I always think about Nordstrom, right? And they're the poster child for having a super simple and easy return experience. Or Zappos, right?
Sure.
I mean, we can all relate to like, yeah, I'm buying one pair of shoes and so I bought, you know, 10 pairs and I'm trying them out at home and I'm returning the 9 that don't fit best. They created that, right? And so it really is about, you know, if you make it easy for customers, they will shop more with you. And in a world where acquiring new customers is getting more expensive every year, right? And, you know, I'm a recovering CMO. So, you know, so I lived this for a long time. You know, the acquisition costs are getting more expensive in Facebook and social media and, you know, even in search. If you can retain more customers, if your existing customers buy more from you, then you don't have to pay as much to go get new ones. And so things like making returns easy, again, a little counterintuitive, but if you can make it easy for your customers, they're going to reward you by shopping more. Again, kind of counterintuitive, but you know, when you spend 4 years thinking about one problem, you know, you kind of uncover some unique insights. Most retailers that sell online are pretty concentrated, meaning if they did a decile analysis and they looked at like, okay, what percent of my sales is my top 10%? And then what percent is my next 10%, right? What they'd find is that they're pretty concentrated, right? So it wouldn't be uncommon to say, you know, your top 10% of customers are half of your business. If you go and you look at the return rates by decile as well, what you'd find is your best customers, they buy the most from you, but they also return the most. And if you think about it, it makes sense, right? It's kind of like shots on goal in like a hockey game, right? Like, you know, your best customers are going to buy things from you across categories, right? They're going to buy across the assortment. You know, when you introduce something new, they're going to try it. How do you get your best customers to buy more from you? Well, you solve that problem, right? You make it easy for them to return. Again, totally counterintuitive, but makes sense when you look at the data. It's like, you know, solve this thing, which is the people's least favorite part of shopping online. If you can solve it, you can make it easy for them. They're going to reward you by buying more.
You know, the reason I was saying 10, 20 years is because we were talking early on, like, yeah, 10% of the American or 10 to 12% is happening online right now. What does the world look like, or what does the US look like when we hit, you know, 50 to 80%? I just wonder how that's going to change the shape of our cities, the behaviors that people have, what stores are. Like, it just, I don't know what the time frame is for us to hit that, but I just wonder how, you know, most people's experience is going to change.
Yeah, a lot more distribution centers.
Yeah.
I'll tell you that, right? It's interesting when you know, Amazon was in the news recently going from, you know, 2-day shipping to 1-day shipping. It's not that they're moving things faster, right? The way that they're doing that is that they've now positioned inventory in all the major cities, right? And so it's easy to do that when the inventory is there. The sort of instant gratification, because the inventory is near the customers, and the instant gratification of, you know, being able to return and get your money back quickly. And, you know, that's kind of where we're headed. What we are doing is we're basically starting to solve, you know, in logistics, people talk a lot about the last mile problem, right?
Yeah.
In reverse logistics, which is our business, we talk a lot about the first mile problem, right? Which is getting the item from the customer injected into, you know, our network. That I think is going to be the biggest change, is the sort of, you know, where is inventory positioned and where are the return options positioned in relation to the customer to try to, you know, make commerce happen at just a faster rate.
Yeah. And there were companies like Ship, S-H-Y-P, that were trying to solve some of this in a more broad way. They ended up going after eBay sellers a lot, who needed to do a lot of just like random shipping of things. But in the long term, do you see a way that Happy Returns like could come to your door somehow and like actually, or is the economics of it just not possible at that level?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And it's actually one that we get a lot, especially as we were fundraising, people would ask about that. Like, is there a Happy Returns partnership with an Uber, right? Where someone comes and picks items up from your door, or there's a business that we like a lot. We share some investors called Deliv, which is focused on sort of a, you know, a crowdsourced kind of delivery service. What we have determined, or at least our hypothesis today, and this comes from talking to a lot of customers about their expectations for returns, is that people really expect returns to be free.
Hmm.
And so what that means practically is that means that the retailer has to bear the cost of it.
Right.
And the challenge with home pickup is that it's expensive. You know, you have to dispatch a driver to go drive to someone's house.
Yeah. What's the minimum cost? Like when you're doing Postmates or Uber Eats or whatever, it's 10, 15 bucks.
Exactly.
Or
yeah. So we always think about sort of, you know, 15 bucks an hour is kind of what, mm-hmm. you know, that driver is probably making. Add in then the cost of having that driver, right? So, you know, sort of grossing that up to think about benefits and et cetera. That's a pretty expensive proposition if somebody's going and they're picking up one item an hour.
Right.
You know, you have to have multiple pickups in an hour to start to make the economics work. And so that would suggest that you need a lot of density.
Mm.
And the reality is like, yeah, there's probably density for, you know, delivery. Returns tend to be more episodic, you know, mm-hmm. and not necessarily something that, you know, especially if it's sort of happening at the pace of the shopper themselves. And so we've sort of said, hey, until either shopper attitudes change and shoppers are willing to pay for it, or until retailers really embrace this additional cost, you know, we're going to focus on actually trying to make returns cheaper by the return bars and getting the first mile for free versus having to pay for it.
What about these drones and stuff that you've got going on?
That could be the game changer.
Because Amazon's right? got those like flying ones, and then there's a couple companies trying these like rolling drones that drive around. I have very low expectations for those like little driving drones.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You know, it's funny. We, Mark, my partner, co-founder, and I often talk about what would the perfect return experience be?
Uh-huh.
And we talk about the magic box is what we call it. So imagine if, you know, every shopper had the magic box.
Like a teleportation device?
No.
Or what are you talking about?
Just like a box that no matter, you know, if you bought something online and you didn't want it, all you had to do is go like drop it in the box and everything would be taken care of, right? And you know, when we started the business 4 years ago, that we would laugh about that, right?
Yeah.
Now, if you think about the idea of a drone, maybe that's not so crazy, right? The idea that, you know, an individual shopper could have a box that would be where the drone would deliver things. The drone is there. They could also pick things up. It's like, maybe that's not so crazy that the magic box could actually exist for returns.
Well, it's interesting. We're here in downtown LA. There's a tour that you can go to that is by the LA Conservancy, which is like an architectural nonprofit, where you can go on a tour of mailboxes in the old like Art Deco buildings. And a lot of them have these like incredible mail chutes because they're tall buildings, but they're just like really beautiful. And especially in dense cities, like I could see something like that where you just put your returns in a hole and then something
like the pneumatic tube, it just goes away.
Yeah. Well, Lumi helps companies with packaging. And I think like the Skunk Works version of Lumi would be like, let's invent teleportation because that would solve the problem completely. And I think it's the same way with reverse logistics, but that, you know, that's a hard problem to solve. We haven't really made very much progress on it yet. You mentioned something, you said you were a recovering CMO. What lessons, we've got a lot of founders and entrepreneurs listening, and you were part of several companies kind of in the wave kind of before where we're at today in e-commerce. And I'm curious if there are lessons that you learned from that you can impart to the people today, or has the landscape changed so much that now, you know, the things that you learned as a CMO 5 years ago no longer apply? How do you look at the landscape? And if you're advising other founders, what do you tell them?
Well, I mean, one clear lesson for me was I don't ever want to have the conversation about lifetime value versus CAC again.
Okay.
it was just, you know, like nightmares and waking up in cold sweats in the middle of the night thinking about customer acquisition costs rising. If there's a lesson in that, I would say it's, you know, really thinking about customer experience and retention. You know, I think for a long time, and this was true of, you know, Hotlook, where I worked in marketing, and Revolve, where I worked in marketing, acquiring customers was sort of the answer. It was, oh, we'll just acquire more customers. We'll acquire more customers. And it was easier to some degree to invest in those marketing campaigns that would buy new customers, as opposed to really thinking about, well, why is it that so many don't come back and buy again, right?
Yeah.
Because oftentimes, you know, it's not clear, right? I mean, it's really hard to get data, for example, on people that don't come back to your site because they don't come back for a reason. And so they're not necessarily going to respond to your survey or tell you why they're not coming back, right? And so understanding what it was about, you know, that interaction is hard. And so as a result, I think it was easier for companies to just say, well, let's just go acquire new customers, right? But at a certain point, you've probably saturated your target market with your advertising, and it's going to get more expensive, right? The easy customers you've already gotten. And so it's going to be more expensive and harder. And, you know, and then at the same time, a lot of companies were waking up to the idea of, oh, I can spend money effectively online to acquire customers. I can measure it. I can understand the return on investment. And so there was a lot of pressure on customer acquisition costs, also just because of sort of supply and demand, you know, more people paying to try to get to the same people. And so I think, you know, if there was an overarching lesson, it would really be about how can we as a brand architect a customer experience, which is great, recognizing that there are these limitations, especially when you think about shopping online. How can we really focus on the experience so that we don't have to continue to go chasing and spending money against acquiring new ones? How can we just retain the ones that we have, right? And how can we make the ones that we have super loyal to our brand? You know, that would be the one kind of key lesson, I think, from, you know, from all the time and money spent measuring this.
Yeah.
There are a finite amount of customers.
Right.
And so, you know.
Yeah, repeat business is just so much easier if you've built that to not have to convince from scratch someone to come back to you and just create a really great experience for people who have already bought from you to buy something again.
And this is even true, you know, in our business today. You know, if you lose a customer, it's really hard to get them back, right?
For sure.
And so, you know, if you can cherish and hold dear the ones that you have convinced to trust you enough to buy something with you, then yeah, I think that's the lesson.
It feels like we're kind of in a Cambrian explosion right now because there's so many brands popping up every day that are taking this like DTC model and running with it and taking a look at, you know, an outdated vertical in the CPG space or any other place. And so there's a lot of specialization currently. There's a lot of companies that they're doing something very specific. We've interviewed a lot of them on this show. They've gone after, let's make the perfect knife or the perfect crock pot or the perfect, you know, whatever it is. And so those types of companies, especially the ones who are selling a specific product, Casper comes to mind, like, hey, I'm making a mattress. How many times do I need to buy a mattress over the course of, you know, 5 years? Is there anything from your lessons there that applies to that type of company? Because, you know, they don't necessarily have the same ability. Once you have a mattress, you're probably not going to buy another one right away.
Yeah. Well, I think sort of the utility of the experience, right? I'll give you a good example. So we're talking to a company now that is doing cookware, right?
Right.
And there's been an explosion in this specific category as well. People are sort of reinventing, you know, your pots and pans at home.
Yeah.
And they're really thinking about the life cycle of someone buying pots and pans. And one of the interesting things that they've learned is that, you know, we all have finite amount of storage in our kitchens.
Mm-hmm.
And when you buy a new pan, typically there isn't really a great place to put it.
Mm.
The place to put it is where the old pan was, right?
Sure.
And so they're actually thinking about creating incentives for people to bring their old pots and pans in and to then actually dispose of them in an ethical way, not just throwing it in the trash and putting it in the landfill, but, you know, it's not as much about returns as it is about this idea of like,
exchange,
bring your used pots and pans
in
exchange for an incentive to buy new ones.
That's fascinating.
I thought so too, because it was really, you know, you don't think about it, but yeah, in my kitchen, right? If I got a brand new pot and pan set, like, well, there isn't room for it unless we got rid of the old one. And so, you know, and so that I think is a good example of, you know, really trying to think through the whole journey, right? And recognizing that there's sort of this, you're creating another task by having somebody buy something from you. And so how can we make the entire journey of that customer's experience be better? I think that type of approach is important. And I also think just recognizing, like, you know, we're all competing. You know, it's like a human being only has so much of an attention span. And I know I've got somebody trying to sell me clothes and somebody trying to sell me shoes and pots and pans and, you know, better razors and, you know, better mattress and all, you know, it's overwhelming for the customer, right? And so, you know, thinking through the journey and then also just making it really simple, I think is another, you know, kind of key learning, you know, that I've observed. And certainly as a consumer, you know, it's just hard and I feel bombarded by all the advertising messages.
So is that a customer you ended up taking on with that goal, or is that something you're exploring? Or how would you entertain that from other folks who are thinking about that type of problem?
Yeah. So, you know, we've built this return bar network. You know, our location partners are excited about the foot traffic. They're excited whether somebody's coming in to do a return or to drop something off. So I think there are a bunch of interesting applications for our network that are not necessarily focused on returns. You know, another kind of interesting one that kind of came at us the other day is product recalls.
Mm.
It's a challenge to operate a product recall. You know, there are requirements for the company that is having to sponsor the recall around making sure that items are actually picked up and then making sure that they're disposed of in the correct manner. This especially comes up with things like consumer electronics. And so how do you do that? And could a return bar network be useful for something like that?
I'm thinking of like at least three or four different, completely different things. One is like the Salvation Army Goodwill type of model where like, you know, you're bringing back a bunch of stuff where the condition of it may be like very different in quality, and some of it they might just have to throw out, some of it they can resell, but that's a business model that exists. Then I'm thinking about, you know, Apple has been doing a lot of work around returns where you can bring in your old iPhone if you're upgrading to a new one, and they've got, I mean, they can refurbish them, but they've also got this like crazy robot they've been talking about that like will disassemble it and separate all the pieces of it and recycle them in whatever way. And then you're talking about product recalls where maybe that inventory needs to be destroyed. Like it's an actual bad, I mean, I'm not sure what kind of recall you're talking about, but if it's something that had like salmonella or something like that, you know, you need to be able to like dispose of it. So like these are all very different things, but this is a problem that we have as a society today. There's like a lot of stuff, and how do we dispose of it in a way that makes sense for the world?
Yeah. Well, so if we could kind of come back to where the conversation started, you know, and I was talking about our mission. We talked about shoppers and we talked about retailers and we talked about location partners, and the planet is actually kind of our fourth main stakeholder. And I think building on your comment, we spend a lot of time thinking about the waste in returns, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, today happens to be Tuesday and it's trash day in my neighborhood. And so I was out there this morning at, you know, 6 a.m. stomping on boxes, trying to fit them into my recycling bin. There's a lot of waste from e-commerce, right?
Yeah,
and just packaging waste alone, right?
Yeah.
And then you think about, you know, the headlines of late that China's no longer buying our recycled cardboard.
We wrote a long story about that on our blog recently. Yeah, it's very fascinating.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the areas that we're investing in is reusable totes as opposed to cardboard.
Yep.
With the idea that, you know, especially when you think about like return bar to return hub shipments, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we control that. You know, we give the return bars the packaging. It gets shipped to a facility that we control. We should be able to completely eliminate cardboard from that step. You know, so we're starting to think about better for the planet, right? Are there ways, you know, e-commerce, you know, is going to create all this packaging, right? You know, and when you think about a future, you know, I think about a lot of boxes and a lot of distribution centers. Are there things that we can do to try to reduce that by just being smarter about the choices that we make for something like that type of shipment, right? So we're starting to replace all of our return bar to return hub shipments with reusable totes. We're now tackling the next leg of it will be from the return hub back to the retailer. It's easy if the retailer controls their fulfillment center. It starts to get harder if there's a third-party logistics provider involved, which a lot of our direct consumer brands have 3PL relationships. And so then there's, you know, sort of three parties to it because, you know, these reusable totes are more expensive and we can't afford to have them just get thrown out. And so we have to make sure that, so there's a lot of work left to do here, but I think we're starting to take steps in the right direction, which is, can we recognize that returns, you know, e-commerce returns create a lot of waste, and can we do our part in trying to make it a little bit better for the planet than just lots of cardboard boxes, you know, headed to the landfill.
Awesome. By the way, is there a directory like of the brands? If I'm a customer at the end, how do I figure out if I can send it to Happier Returns or not?
Yeah, so you can find a list of the retailers we work with on our website, or most of the retailer, in fact, all of the retailers that we work with will promote Happier Returns in their returns section. Hey, you now have another option. Most will direct you to what we call the return bar locator, which is basically, you know, just like a store locator. You can put in your zip code or your city or your state and see the ones that are near you. And so that locator is updated in real time as we add new locations.
Cool. And it's just happyreturns.com. So lots of good info on your website. Is there anything else we should send people to?
Nope. That would be the place.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, David.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
Ooh, one last thing before we go. I'm talking to you at home. What's your favorite brand these days? Is there something that you think is really well made? Or maybe someone that you'd love for me to talk to, send us a tweet. We are at Lumi, L-U-M-I, on Twitter. We're making this show for you, so tell us what you want to hear, and we'll make it happen. Thanks. See you next time.